What is that?
Oh, it's such a good apple. Oh, man.
Jeez.
It's so juicy.
Here we go. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith Podcast for January 2019. I'm your host, Jonathan Buchan, and I'm joined once again by the one-legged wonder, Tim Nelson.
Hey. You're not only insulting me, you're insulting people that have only one good leg everywhere.
I'm sorry, you're right. But Tim, what happened to your ankle? Can you tell the story?
So, you would think that there are certain sports where you can get injured, right?
Yes.
Football, I've played some football, I did some wrestling, you know, snowboarding. These are things I normally do, well, I have in the past. This time I was injured going to a movie.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah. So like I turned my ankle real bad and might have messed up some ligaments. I thought I might have broke it and I heard a tear crossing the street
Get
to the Oriental Theater because there's some uneven Milwaukee road repair sidewalks.
To say the least.
And some not so coordinated walking.
So would it be fair to say that just as in football back in the day that you put your body on the line to see the movie we're podcasting on today?
I guess what I'm saying is, folks, I got injured in the before the game and I still suited up and went into that movie.
Yeah.
And in pain with no painkillers.
Yeah.
No popcorn.
Yeah.
And I went into that movie with almost a broken ankle, not quite.
Literally, the previews were going in. I was touch and go. I was like, do you need to go to the doctor now? And you're just like, I'm playing through. And you took off your boot and put your foot up, and that was that.
I didn't want him to have to cut the boot off.
Right.
That's pretty cool. So I guess what I'm trying to say is I am the toughest moviegoer you've ever seen.
Oh, my gosh. Let's just give a shout out to Tim. That's an amazing thing. Thank you, Tim, for sacrificing to be here tonight. And,
Yeah.
All right. So for our regular segment at the top, which is, of course, what have you been watching? I think we have to talk about the Golden Globes, Tim. What happened at the Golden Globes?
So I only watched some of it. We were texting back and forth.
Yeah.
I hadn't committed to watching
it.
So when things would happen, I would try. But I was talking to my wife through the whole thing. But it looked like some weird stuff went down.
Very weird night. Now, it's fair to say the Globes are always a little weird, right? It's first of all, it's like a big party. Like, you have the Oscars, which are very much like a theater environment. Everyone's sitting, you know, nicely in chairs. But this is more like tables, alcohol flowing. You know, even like my favorite part of the Golden Globes is just watching people talk with each other, right?
It's just weird. Imagine how you would do anything, and then imagine French people were doing that same thing. So it's like slower, less pressure.
Yeah.
People are wasted.
Someone's giving a speech and it's like, oh, there's Will Ferrell talking to Al Pacino. And you're just like, wait, what?
It's like at tables. You know, there's lots of things being served. It's not like people aren't busting out the best dress they own or that they're, it's more laid back.
Julia Roberts, I think, wore jeans.
It's a party. It really is.
Yeah.
It's more fun in some ways for the celebrities, I think.
It is. But what also makes it weird is that it's voted on by literally 90 people. Like, they're called the Hollywood Foreign Press. They're made up of foreign correspondents. And they're not in the industry, right? And there's just 90 people. And so that's going to naturally create some different results than the Academy, which makes up the Oscars, which are literally made up of thousands of people that work in Hollywood. So you're naturally going to get a few weird things every year. But this definitely was the most, I heard someone say on Twitter, it was the most Golden Globes that we've had in a long time, right? Yeah, it was bad. So you've only caught a glimpse of it. I would say the first weird thing.
It was on. I just wasn't paying attention.
That's okay. First weird thing was The Kominsky Method winning Best TV Show. Okay, this is a show with Michael Douglas on Netflix, right? And I researched this. I never watched it, but I researched it, and no critic was going crazy over the show. It was like, it's fine, was basically the general consensus, was you could watch it if you've run out of, you know, your other great TV shows to watch. But like, the fact that this won over The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Barry, that's crazy. I mean, that was like a first glimpse that something's off tonight, right? So that was TV.
So you care more than I care about this.
That's true.
You were like angry. You got passion. You've got heart.
Increasingly
here.
Got angry. Yeah. But that was like the first red flag. And then when you got to movies, it got worse. Okay. So Green Book wins in the best musical or comedy over The Favorite, which is mind-boggling to me. Now, I like Green Book. I think it's a good movie. There's a lot of controversy on the sidelines of it because apparently they did not respect the family of Dr. Shirley, who the movie centers around, and that's a mess. But if you just take the movie as the movie, not knowing any of that, I think it's a good movie. It's in my top 10. But The Favorite is a great movie, and the fact that that would win over that was really shocking to me. So you I haven't seen it.
I've only seen The Favorite. I haven't seen The Green
Book. You have seen The Favorite?
Yeah.
What did you think of it? I haven't had this conversation with you.
It's just a lot of freaking weird stuff going on in that movie.
It is, but it was really well done.
I've learned if you want to get into a position of power,
yeah,
you got to do some things.
Did you like it more or less than The Lobster?
Less.
Okay. But yeah, so Green Book winning was a huge thing. But the cherry on top, really the unforgivable sin, was what happened at the end. And that was what won Best Drama. Did you catch that at all?
The Bohemian Rhapsody movie.
Bohemian Rhapsody. Yeah. Now, I saw that.
You did see it? Because I haven't seen this. I'm not like, John, in awards season, it's like finals week for John.
I know.
It's 2 months for John.
Yeah. It's like see six movies every week. And yeah, no, I saw Bohemian Rhapsody.
You're heavily committed during this time. And I am not. And I begin to feel guilty.
No,
you don't have to.
You don't have to, except you might be out of the loop a little bit on our live tweeting coming up on Oscar night, but you'll still provide some witty banter, which is what you do.
I will just fake it till I make it. That's what they say. So so tell us about this. So you saw Bohemian Rhapsody. I feel like I'm like, you ever been in a group with a group project?
Uh-huh.
That's how I feel about the Oscar, the Academy Awards, is I show up and I didn't, I kind of slacked on my group project because I didn't see like 25 movies in the last 2 months of the year, like, and paid big bucks to do it. Like you did, and Dan sometimes does.
No,
Dan doesn't do it either.
You're the only one. Yeah, I'm the only one. And I don't think it's not something to be proud of, so I think you guys are probably doing it right.
Well, it's the time of year where you get angry at the movies.
I do. This is the time where you get sick of movies, right? Exactly.
Why can't just one shine? Then we can just focus on that one.
Yeah. No, Bohemian Rhapsody is very mediocre. This is a B-minus, at best, Queen vanity project. It is not a good movie by any stretch. I will say Rami Malek, who plays Freddie Mercury, is really good in it, and he's probably going to get nominated for an Oscar, and I think he deserves that nomination.
So the acting is good.
Yes, but the movie itself is just the Queen's greatest hits. Literally, like, the last part of the movie is 10 minutes of the Live Aid performance. Like, it's the last part of the movie. It's not advancing the story. It's a concert that you're watching unfold for 10 minutes. It's just... So the fact that that would win Best Drama over If Beale Street Could Talk, over A Star Is Born, is unbelievable. And even BlacKkKlansman and Black Panther, which are in that category, which I don't think should be in the awards discussion, it's a better movie than
both
of those.
Black Panther is in the Best Drama?
Yes, yes. Okay.
That's super weird.
It is. And I don't think it deserves it, and neither does BlacKkKlansman. But it's still, Bohemian Rhapsody is a worse movie than all of them, and I cannot believe it won. And
It seemed kind of like a pet project, like a vanity project.
It's what it was.
You're not the only person that thought that was absolute Chris. There were others too that were like, this makes no sense. Mm-hmm. What were these folks thinking? Do you think maybe
it's not trash? It's an okay movie.
I get you.
Yeah,
I get you.
Right. So what I'm hoping is that the Oscars can wash away this mess, and they still can. Okay, the nominations are announced.
What can wash away this sin?
Oh no! Don't say that.
The Oscars.
What can? Yes.
So you're hoping the Oscars can wash away this sin?
I'm hoping, because in 1 week from when we're recording this, on January 22nd, they're going to announce the nominees. They're voting right now, okay? And so I'm hoping that the Academy gets in there. I'm hoping that Bohemian Rhapsody doesn't even get nominated for Best Picture, because it has no business being in the Best Picture
category. This is the NFL draft for people that don't like sports.
Right. Well,
is that what we're dealing with here?
Yeah, that's what's so weird about the Globes, is they in some ways they don't matter and they always award weird films, but in some ways they do, because the Academy voting starts right after the Globes, right? So the people, everyone who's voting are the people sitting in the audience, all those celebrities, they're all voting. So they're influenced by who wins a little bit. They're influenced by a great speech. So it plays into their votes. But I'm really hoping that, Bohemian Rhapsody doesn't even get in the Best Picture nominees, and when those nominations get announced. I'm also hoping, by the way, that You Were Never Really Here, which I rave about every podcast with Joaquin Phoenix, actually factors into the awards discussion, because it's been dead on arrival. It's one of those films that came out really early
in
the year, but it's still, to date, I believe, the best movie of the year.
A lot of folks like that movie. I saw it, like I said last podcast, I think I mentioned it, I saw it. I need to rewatch it. Hadn't had time. But I've been watching good films, but not these ones. But go ahead.
Is Roma still officially your favorite film of the year? Are you hoping that goes all the way?
It's my favorite film of the year.
Okay.
I would say it's my favorite film of the last 2 years.
Wow. That's a big deal. There you go.
It makes what's the other one? What's the Del Toro one from last year?
Shape of Water.
It makes Shape of Water look like garbage.
Yeah, for sure. I'm with you on that.
I mean, and that's a good film, right?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
I just think this is, I am like, these Mexican directors, man, they rock. Even if they don't live in Mexico anymore, like like Cuarón.
And Cuarón did win for Best Director for the Globes. And so that's a good sign for him. Yeah.
It was a beautiful movie.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful movie.
So we'll see what happens. The Oscars are the announcement is on January 22nd, where they announce the nominees. So that will be the first sign of things to come. But yeah, the Globes, what a mess. All right. So let's get to our topic for the evening. And that is this movie that you put your body on the line for. We traveled to our favorite theater, the Oriental, and we saw a movie by the name of If Beale Street Could Talk. And that is the movie we're going to be talking about tonight. So we cannot talk about Beale Street without mentioning the director's last film. And that was, of course, Moonlight. Barry Jenkins is the director of Beale Street, and Moonlight was the Best Picture winner of 2016 after quite a mess. Now, we talked about this a little bit with our First Man podcast. I actually included the audio of that whole debacle of La La Land.
I remember that you did that.
La La Land won, and then they had to get off the stage because Moonlight won. There was an envelope switch. You can go back and listen to our First Man podcast if you want to listen to the audio of that. But suffice it to say, that was a crazy moment.
It wasn't Warren Beatty's fault.
It was not.
What I remember we came to. We discovered this. Yes.
At first, everyone blamed Warren Beatty. Did you watch that live when that happened?
Yes.
Yes. That was one of those once-in-a-lifetime live moments.
I was in I remember right where I was when that happened.
That was
like,
crazy.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I think we were texting. That was nuts. But as far as Moonlight is concerned, that movie to me is one of the best movies I've seen in the last, I would say, 5 years. I saw that movie, and when I came out of it, I just had one word on my mind, and it was masterpiece. That movie grabbed me from minute one, never let go, and I think it is a perfect film from beginning to end. Loved it. In fact, I gave it a straight A accordingly, and I have not given any movie on my top 10 list a straight A this year. So when one comes from me, you know it's in rare territory. So Moonlight is a masterpiece in my mind. Did you also feel the same about Moonlight? What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I love that it was filmed in three different forms of film stock. I love the, it's just, there's a softness to the, there's like this hardness, softness, like the softness of the film itself and the lighting and everything is like real warm. And like the blue is blue and the earth tones are really earthy and the white is really white. And there's something to that softness and like vividness that contrasts with the difficult subject matter.
Yep.
And so, so that juxtaposition like catches you.
Yeah.
And it invites you in, and then you're like, oh, this is difficult.
Yes.
But I just think it's a beautiful film. I mean, there's like several scenes that I think of in that movie, especially when the man is holding the boy and he's floating and he's teaching him in the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's just like one of the most beautiful scenes I've ever seen in cinema.
Mahershala Ali, Best Supporting for that. And it was just so beautiful. Yeah. So Moonlight was actually Barry Jenkins' second movie. And then his debut, I have not seen. That
date, it's like 2008 or something.
Yeah. It's called Medicine for Melancholy. I have not seen it. I don't even know if it's available anywhere. The plot is, and I quote, 24 hours in the tentative relationship of two young San Franciscos also dealing with the conundrum of being a minority in a rapidly gentrifying city. That's the plot. I would be interested in seeing it. It's his debut movie, but I have not seen that. So that's Medicine for Melancholy. And then, of course, Moonlight, which won Best Picture. And now we are on his third film, which is If Beale Street Could Talk. And that's what we're going to be talking about right now. So, yeah, here we go. So let's go ahead and describe the movie for those who have no idea what we're talking about.
We can't spoil anything.
We can't spoil anything.
This is terrible.
See, I do think the statute of limitations applies to films in the current year. So unfortunately, we'll have to try to keep spoilers to a minimum. But If Beale Street Could Talk is an adaptation of a novel by the same name, which came out in 1974 and was written by James Baldwin. Now, I am not terribly familiar with James Baldwin's works. Have you actually read anything Baldwin wrote?
No, of course not.
I know. I haven't read a lot of Baldwin. I've read the only authors that he's influenced and been influenced by. So Richard Wright, mm-hmm. Maya Angelou, Toni Morrison.
Okay.
But I haven't read Baldwin. But I have not either. Should.
There was a great quote at the beginning of If Beale Street Could Talk, which is actually from James Baldwin. I don't know whether it was a quote that he said at some other point separate from the movie or whether it was actually in the preface to the book. It could have been. But it was basically saying that Beale Street is a street in actually Memphis. And right?
He was saying, all right, so I've been to Beale Street in Memphis a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And first off, the barbecue sucks on Beale Street. Go to somewhere else. Go to Rendezvous. There's one by the Civil Rights Museum. But anyway, so mm-hmm. apparently Beale Street is also, it's in New Orleans.
It's in New Orleans. Okay. Mm-hmm. That I didn't know.
Yeah.
And what the quote was saying was that Beale Street is sort of a representation in Baldwin's mind for every... he actually says it's a generalization for the black experience in America, that basically every black person in America grew up on a Beale Street. Wherever they actually ended up or did actually grow up, that Beale Street is representative of.
And doesn't he say like Louis Armstrong lived on Beale Street for a while?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So that's really interesting, and that forms the preface to If Beale Street Could Talk. Even though this movie takes place in New York, Beale Street kind of becomes this backdrop for this is everyone was born on Beale Street. And the movie centers around this young black couple. They live in New York back in the 70s at a time where it was really hard to be a black person in America. Of course, you could argue not much has changed in that regard, but the racism and oppression was even more on the surface than it is now. And you get, because at that period, you could not get an apartment. It was very difficult to for a landlord to rent you an apartment. The police many times were openly racist.
Well, I think there was like, well, we still have a lot of this stuff going on, but I think this is the era of like, no, there actually is on the, like, I can't sell you this property because it actually says you can't live here.
Uh-huh.
Like right. on the, it has restricted deeds and like, you have legal things that are preventing people from, I mean, we talked a little bit about this with, I forgot the one with the couple that, the Supreme Court and the couple that got married and it was illegal.
Loving.
And, Loving. Yeah. But like there's at this point, there's still tons and tons of laws on the books, even if you say this is like toward the end of civil rights, you know, civil rights movement, there were still tons of laws on the books. There's still like, we're just beginning to question a lot of the stuff that's been going on for the last, you know, 15 years before we get to this movie.
Right. And a lot of the same oppression exists today, but it's under the guise of quote, color blindness in the legal system. Right. Quote unquote. Yeah.
Yeah.
But back then it was actually laws on the books.
It's
so
just it's just coded more now.
Exactly.
Not like law code, but coded in the sense of like, it's more below the surface more.
Yep. So it was hard to get an apartment and there were cops that were openly racist that would drag you into the station for no reason. And so it was a scary time.
Those two things still are occurring.
They still are occurring. I want to make that known too. Absolutely.
Like African Americans are still getting dragged to the into the police station for nothing.
Or shot for nothing. Absolutely.
And people are still show up to a rental property and they'll go, oh, we already rented it. And that's still real.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so maybe that, for white folks, black folks already know, like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
But like, that's still real now.
I think that's really important.
It hasn't really changed.
It hasn't changed. We should just leave it at that. It hasn't really changed. It looks like that maybe the fact that it was more blatant is an illusion. I agree with you. So this young couple, Tish and Fonny are their names. They're madly in love. And right at the start of the film, we find out that Fonny has been arrested for a crime that he didn't commit. There was a woman that was raped and Fonny was brought into this lineup under false pretenses and the woman misidentifies him as the rapist. So we know he's innocent and he's in jail for this crime. And we find that out right from the start. And then the movie is sort of goes back and forth between the present day reality of Fonny in prison and everyone fighting to get him out. And then flashbacks of how Tish and Fonny fell in love and what their lives looked up leading up to the arrest. So that's basically the plot of the movie in a nutshell.
It's achronological.
Yes, very much so. So I want to go back to...
Well, that's not true. There's time, but it's just like, it's not in order.
That's right. It's not linear. So I want to go back to Barry Jenkins and talk about him from a writing and directing standpoint. So Tim, what do you feel that Jenkins brings to his movies as both a writer and director? What is his signature style, if you had to quantify it?
So this is what I would say that stands out about his work, which it shouldn't, but it does, is he's able to portray intimate African-Americans in intimate, loving relationships that are sensual, but also gentle. He portrays African Americans as gentle. Mm-hmm. So even in some of the movies that we see that we would think of as being like, oh, this is like trying to show us this African American experience, we see a lot of characters that are hardened, mm-hmm. not gentle.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would give us something that I think is really beautiful, which is like, no. The strength is not, you're going to see some strong people, but a lot of their strength is what they can endure and still maintain a posture of being loving in the midst of what they're enduring.
And that is unfortunately rare in cinema. Yeah.
So you're seeing black folks like entering into like deep, loving, caring relationships with each other in his films.
Mm-hmm. Even from a father to child, and then in romantic relationships.
And they're super sensual films. Yes. And so, like, even in his scenes, like, you know, with that are more like sexual scenes or sex scenes, mm-hmm. like, it's just totally intimate and care. Like, it's care. And I'm like, wow, not only do you not see this much in, you know, in Hollywood, wow, this is like showing us something that is so an image that is like counter to all the bull crap out there. Mm-hmm. And it's saying, no. This is not the, we are not going to let D.W. Griffith define the black experience for us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's so you get this different perspective,
mm-hmm.
but it's like, okay, yes, there is civil rights. Yes, mm-hmm. there is. It's okay. You could be radicalized. Okay. We see all these things, but I think primarily it's like very much he's interested in these personal relationships that people would consider, oh, these are just normal relationships,
mm-hmm.
fathers and mothers and sons and daughters. And instead of having to make the movie, I'd say instead of making the movie bigger than that, he focuses on like the micro.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's going to make a macro statement.
And there's sensual films in, I want to say in a wholesome way. And I know that sounds weird because I think some of them are, there's some nudity and stuff, but you know what I mean? Like they're sensual in a way that is very the way it's supposed to be. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. It's intimacy.
Yeah.
So what you're seeing is his characters have intimacy, whether it's sexual or non-sexual, there's an intimacy that exists.
Yes.
There's a vulnerability that exists and he does such a good job with that. And the lighting is like critical to this whole thing.
Oh yeah.
It's like a rich, warm mm-hmm. light that he does. And he backlights people constantly.
Well, he's such a visual filmmaker in general. Both movies, you see that in Moonlight and you see it in Beale Street, where he just is so, he has this very elegant modern style of filmmaking that I love.
So Trish is, this is
Tish.
Tish, I'm sorry. Why did I call her Trish? Oh, because I had a nurse named Trish when I went to the emergency room. There anyway, so Tish.
The leg.
Sorry, Trish, if you're listening. Tish. So Tish is one scene that they're going to look at this like awful loft apartment.
Yeah.
Which now everybody be like, oh, I got to get this loft apartment. So you have these huge kind of like windows that go up, you know, 20 feet of like industrial windows. And mm-hmm. then they have her. She has like an afro. And it's pulled back and it's really pretty. And you can, and she turns around and it's like she has a halo.
Yeah.
And so you're looking at it and you're like, because he backlit her correctly. And then they do the lighting in the front. So she's like this warm, beautiful figure.
Yeah.
And then backlit with the sunlight.
It's stunning.
And it makes her look like she has a halo because of her hair.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh my gosh. Like I pointed to you.
You did.
I was like, dude, that is the most beautiful shot. I can't believe. And I don't do that all the time.
And there's shots that you could freeze frame and it's like a work of art. It's like a painting.
Yeah. And he's really good at symbolism and duplicating things. So like there's a scene where they're in a bathtub, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that gets referenced a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm. As kids.
And one of the things is it's like a bathtub that's like in an alcove. And when they first make love, they make love under the stairs, which is like in an alcove.
Oh, that's good.
And there's all these visual cues that they're giving us. Because like when they're little kids in the bathtub, it's like we felt no shame. We were just, we just knew each other. You know, I forgot what the narration is. But the idea is like that they were innocent like Adam and Eve, for instance, right?
Yeah.
And then when they first make love, it's...
They're innocent again. They return to that.
It is. It's like back, oh no, this is just this.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's no... And I don't think that... I'm not getting hung up on the sex part. I just think mm-hmm. that the idea is that portrayal is just like, it's just really good filmmaking.
It really is. Speaking of great lighting, there's this scene where he's working in his wood shop and he's smoking.
Yeah.
And the way the smoke like just billows out around this thing is so beautiful. And I think it's so messed up that like Hollywood consistently portrays smoking as so beautiful from a visual standpoint, but then when you're actually like around someone who's smoking in real life, you're just like super gross. Like, what is that? You know?
I like it. It's like he's breathing life into something.
Ooh, that's good though.
That's yeah. Like, but like that's like the that's a theological. I was like, oh, this is like Genesis. It's because he's building a he's basically building something that's representing something. Mm-hmm. It's abstract because mm-hmm. that's the you know that's the era he's in. And he's building these abstract, he's creating. So I guess like, I feel like we're used to stereotypical characters of African-Americans, but what we see is this artist who all he wants to do is do art. Hmm. He's figured out how to do it. He wants to do art. He wants to be with the love of his life, and he wants to be left alone.
That's it.
That's what he's looking for. Okay. Yep. He wants to get out of the basement apartment and he wants to envision and get into the loft mm-hmm. and he can envision it and he's creative and that's what all he wants is like, let me be left alone. Let me find my way in the world and let me create pieces of art.
Yeah.
That's his desire. It's like that simple. Mm-hmm. It's not like anything beyond what he can attain.
Yeah.
It's like this beautiful, simple idea that why couldn't he have this? Why shouldn't he have this?
Mm-hmm. And then that's interrupted by being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. I also want to point out Barry Jenkins' writing too, because just like his visual composition, I think he has a very modern, crisp writing style. It's like the perfect combination of a very authentic sounding dialogue, but also these lines that stand out and provide a punch right when you need it. You know, it's never cleverness for cleverness sakes. Like sometimes you get into with Tarantino, you know, it's just like, it sounds very natural. And then there'll be a line that's just like, that's good. You know, it's good.
I was thinking like when he's talking to his friend who got out of jail and this friend is describing his experience in vagaries because it's too hard to like discuss specifics. The temptation of the writer there would be like to give him a cool story that would be really graphic, but mm-hmm. he doesn't. The writer holds back and he gives him a vague story that lets your imagination go. And then the lines are so good, which is, you know, he gives him some kind of advice and he's like, I appreciate what you're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And with all respect, you've never been there. And I know you can't, you know, and like, it's like, or something like that.
That was the most haunting scene of the film.
Yeah,
for me.
I know.
It was the combination of that writing and the way the visual aspect, he closes in on it. And then the sound too, he basically cuts out the sound yeah. and it is chilling.
And Tish is like doing dishes or making food or something. And she
yeah.
hears it.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And so that gives you, that's like a key scene for the entire movie.
Yes.
Which is they can do anything they want to your body. Mm-hmm. Which totally links this with, you know, every time we read something, you know, with James Baldwin, it connects us with Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Ta-Nehisi Coates is always talking about the body.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it connects us with I think probably like a kind of a consensus is like, my body does not belong to me. It belongs to white people.
Hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that in the perfume scene.
Yes.
That's another beautiful scene.
Yep.
And it's like, it makes me sick, but it's like so true. It's like the white man always grabs my hand. And then, you know, because she's a perfume. You want to describe the scene? You're better summarizing.
Yeah,
him.
Tish works at a perfume counter. And so normally she'll spray some perfume on her hand. When a black person comes up to sample the perfume, he always takes the bottle and sprays it on his own hand and smells it. Whereas the white person will grab her hand and bring it up to his nostrils. And there's that sense of almost callous entitlement over her arm that the black person doesn't just automatically respect.
Her body belongs, and it's white men mm-hmm. in particular.
Yes.
My body belongs to that white man. He doesn't even question it.
Yes.
And so that he would spray perfume on me and then sniff and grab my hand.
Yep.
Where the black man would spray it on his own hand and smell it.
That's right.
And so I think that like that shows you that's one of the micro points of that film, of the film even, right?
Yep.
It's like, black in America, you don't belong to yourself. I mean, I think that's why we see Baldwin like in France. Mm. I mean, he gets out of here. He's like, I'm getting the hell out of here.
I didn't even know this place. He moved to France
and died there.
Oh man. Okay.
Yeah. He's like, I'm getting out of here. America's insane.
Well, Ta-Nehisi Coates even mentions that in his book, Between the World and Me, where he actually steps outside. He goes on a vacation to France or something. And he said that the feeling of not having to worry about your body that you feel every day in America, it was like a burden lifted from him that he felt in France. And it was palpable for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny that like the experience of like, you know, the World War One experience and then the African-American experience at post-war, post-World War One, and then the World War Two experience would be that like folks in wartime even recognize this place is safer than back home or I can be a human being here. Or, and so you see like African-Americans, you see like Josephine Baker now, that's, she's a controversial character because she is exotified and all that. Mm-hmm. And you can also look at like the popularity of jazz in France and all this stuff. But you see that in France, like you could be you can be black in France.
Mm-hmm.
And be and not like have to have that burden of like everyone owns my body.
Yes. Yes.
And but not in America.
That's right. One thing I really appreciate about Jenkins too is his sensitivity for what he's portraying in his films. I heard him interviewed a few times recently and he's just really humble in his approach to filmmaking. He actively seeks out other people's opinions that are closer to the subject matter at hand and incorporates that feedback into his movie. So one of them was the sex scene that we were talking about under the enclave. He actually was planning on shooting that differently and he listened to feedback from women on how on like he was going to keep, he was, I think he was going to stay focused on just her while he goes and does the record. And the women were like, no, if that was a woman going over by the record player, you would linger on, you know, her body. So,
and he does,
it takes it over to him. And that's
interesting. I like that actually.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I didn't think about that. Is that there's kind of there's an equality to the scene that you don't see in most scenes. Usually you don't see that.
Mm-hmm.
That scene has a certain egalitarian nature to it. And I think exactly for the reasons you're describing.
Yeah. And then the other one was that scene where all the family is over at the house, all the in-laws, everything. He said when he was going through the editing process, in his mind, that was an easy scene to cut. It was just like, get that out of there, and then it'll help the flow of the movie or whatever. And his editor, who is a black woman, her name's Joy McMillan, she said, you cannot cut this scene because you have to trust me on this, that this scene, that there is everyone represented here is important to the people watching it.
Absolutely.
And that was so interesting. And so he left it in based on her recommendation. And then I was totally separately listening to a black film critic that I respect who was talking about this movie. And he said he was moved to tears watching that scene because he could see every member of his family represented in that room.
Yeah.
How cool is that? Just the ability to listen to other people instead of being an arrogant director who's like, well, for the sake of the movie, we must blah blah blah. You know,
yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah, that was a critical scene. I could see why it could get on the cutting room floor though, because it doesn't. That scene exists, and it's almost an independent. That scene could be independent of the movie. Like
exactly.
You could just watch that scene. Like that could be like a film student project. Just that scene. Obviously, it's better quality.
Mm-hmm.
Because it has that much tension and that much fire in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you've already kind of covered the family dynamic prior to that. So I could see where you'd be tempted to cut it. But the fact that that movie spoke to people in a way that he couldn't have thought, and the movie's better for it.
Yeah.
But let's be honest for a little bit about Beale Street, because there are some flaws, in my opinion. Now, I have not heard your official take, but I ran into some troubles with the way the movie was constructed. What is your, if you had to level some criticisms up top here, what would you say?
I don't know how you could do it better.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what you're asking.
I'll just start off. For me, I felt the movie was a little choppy, the going back and forth between the narrative. I don't know. It's just, and how would you do it better? I don't know. If you could make the flashbacks a little bit more flash-like and poetic instead of a literal like time periods that you keep traveling to, I think that would help the flow a little bit. One of the best flashback tools that I've ever seen incorporated in a movie is that movie with Joaquin Phoenix, You Were Never Really Here, where it flashes back to his experience. It's because for the reason that it really does feel like just glimpses that are never explained, that are never, you never see a full scene of the flashback. It's literally just visual glimpses that help you form the character. And it's just a flash. So I don't know if you could do it that way, but
I think that would be jarring for this movie.
It could be.
Yeah, if you just went linear, mm-hmm. I don't know if there would be enough tension in the movie. See, because what you got to do is adapt a book, and so I think that the way he adapts the, and I haven't read the book. Maybe the book is not linear either, but I think for this, it basically gives us new. It's like new revelatory information here, and like at different points. But then there's also scenes that function
as, and I think this, that can function alone, because he's very symbolic and he's very into metaphor, and there are whole scenes that can function on their own. And then ideas, like for instance, the idea of a table being very important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the idea of the main character, well, not the main character, but Fonny. Mm-hmm. So the idea of Fonny is like, wants to work with his hands and make his own table.
He mentions that. Yeah.
That's a metaphor for what he desires. Like that's the American experience, which is, I just want to make my own table with my own two hands. Mm. And then I want to eat dinner with you at it. Simple. Mm-hmm. It's not like a, it's not like this far-fetched, crazy idea. Mm-hmm. It's a simple idea that feels like everyone should be able to achieve this. And I think about the last scene and what is the, and what table, and the table that
the
they're
kind
at.
Of table that they're at. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you're saying that the scenes, the quote unquote flashback scenes, add so much value on that it would be impossible to make them more.
Yeah. Because if you get, yeah. So for instance, I'll give you an example as far as storyline. If you get the revelation, so you know that Fonny's in jail already. Mm-hmm. That, if you get the revelation about how bad jail is prior to his experience, if you just went like chronologically,
yeah,
then you don't have this, it doesn't have the same impact. So like the fact that you go backwards and you learn how bad jail can be.
Mm. While he's in, while you already know he's there.
And you know he's there already. Yeah, and you know that Tish hears, heard that.
That's interesting.
And then you watch, and then it's all these subtle things, like when he's got all the marks on his face because he's clearly gotten beat up or what, something bad. But he's
not even talk about it.
He won't tell her because he doesn't want her to know.
And she doesn't ask.
But she knows.
Yeah.
So she's feeling, like you can see her, she's sick, but she's not going to like put it out there.
And that comes after that
conversation. She's not going to give it the power. So that happens after. So I think there's a lot of craft going on here with that. Mm-hmm. And it does like kind of hammer home some of these points.
What about the voiceover?
Yeah, you're a stickler for voiceover.
You know, right, I'm always about this, and I'm not going to rehash all the points I've made in, 20 of our podcasts. But the point is that I think voiceover is almost always unnecessary unless it becomes its own side character.
Or Morgan Freeman.
That's right. Shawshank Redemption. Yeah, you can't go wrong with that.
I don't know how Andy did it.
Can we just get Morgan Freeman for everything? That'd be fantastic. Yeah. Sometimes it works if it's its own character. Like I've mentioned Goodfellas before, where you literally have multiple characters chiming in with varying perspectives. I think that's good. But I believe that Tish's
Ray Liotta voiceover and everything.
Ray Liotta.
Or is it everybody?
No, it's everybody. That's what's so cool about that. And the perspectives kind of are different from each other, which
I forgot
it really
about
works.
That. I
Such
like
a
that
good
movie quite a bit, yeah.
But I believe that Tish's voiceover, there is nothing she says that you could not tell in a visual way. And I feel it becomes a crutch. And I know it's a temptation when you're adapting a book because, hey, you've got every character's thoughts all printed for and you just plop it in the movie and it ties everything together. But I feel like she's basically just making subtext text, and you could tell it all visually in a better way. That's my opinion.
I think there's something about a pregnant woman doing that that seems like there's dialogue going on. Now, this is a really weird observation.
You mean if she's talking to her baby? Like,
I'm not
internal
saying
thoughts?
She is. I think there's time when she
but
does.
But see, that would work if they actually made that a little bit more
or
obvious.
Or if, like, the Look Who's Talking movies, the baby can talk.
Oh, man, you just took me back.
I'm sorry. Do you remember those?
Yes.
So horrible.
Yes.
So,
I remember, like, the opening credits and the zygote coming into the...
Yeah, it's just disgusting. Yeah. So anyway, I think maybe, is that 3 Minute
John
Baby
Travolta,
that you're thinking of?
Or no, John Travolta. And yeah, it's either Luke Who's Talking 1 or 2. As the opening credits are going, you see the baby being formed in the womb because
nobody talks. I guarantee no other podcast you listen to this year will mention Luke Who's Talking 2. So anyway, don't watch that movie or those series. Those are some of the worst movies ever made. If you like commercials where the dog like moves his mouth, you'll like this.
Why did you bring that up? I'm so confused.
I don't know. I just thought of it. I'm like random, you know? Yeah. Don't have my medication on me. So what I was going to say is, I think that sometimes like when you have a pregnant woman, there is this like, I almost feel like you allow a little bit of that because there is like this, there's something reflective, there's something pensive about someone who is pregnant. Mm. And I don't know, this is my guy impression about that, but the idea is you are carrying life inside and that you are reflecting on that every time you have to go to the bathroom 100 times a day. Mm-hmm. And you're reflecting on that anytime that your normal life is like impeded. Mm-hmm. Or you get kicked in the stomach, which happens the whole time.
And there is, for at least from the way my wife carried, there is a legitimate relationship that's formed in the womb. My wife was talking to my baby all the time. So if you look at it from that way, that's actually really powerful.
So that's one idea.
I wish they would have made that like a thing.
Here's another idea.
Yeah.
Now I'd have to go rewatch the movie. Shouldn't she have someone to talk to? And shouldn't it be her husband?
Ooh.
No. Wouldn't that be where the dialogue naturally would be in a movie?
Yeah. And the absence of that creates the need.
And then it's highlighted by these phone conversations. And isn't the first line is that you should never have to see a loved one behind glass?
Yep.
Which it's like.
You're selling me on this.
Yeah. So the idea of like the narrative, but I don't know, maybe I'm just making apologetic for this narrative that doesn't really need to happen. I think it is incredibly difficult to have like no motivations and internal thoughts and not put that in a narration format mm-hmm. for film. I don't know if it's always lazy. I think sometimes it's hard to do a book adaptation.
For sure. And then the last thing I'll say is that the ending felt incomplete to me. And I feel like, and I know there's the look of Tim going, that's the point. But it's all, I felt like the movie was all building up to a very strong poetic crescendo. And then it just sort of ended flat, in my opinion. And though I totally see the arguments of this is why that happened because of X, Y, and Z, it still has to feel effective to me. And I walked out feeling a little bit let down by the ending.
I wish it was a harsher ending.
Really?
It was too, I mean, it's so subtle.
It very, yes, to a fault.
You know how I usually see the first scene is the summarizes the movie. In this scene, it's the last scene.
Mm-hmm. You said that right when we were leaving. Yeah. That's the whole movie. Yeah. I agree with you.
And we can't talk about it too much. I know. But I would say the last scene summarizes this movie. I guess what I would say is the last scene would question the idea if black folks can have our normal life in America.
Hmm.
I mean, that's, yeah. Mm-hmm. And Baldwin gets to the point where I'm going to go die in France. I'm going to go live in France. I'm going to write in France.
You did it, yeah.
Because it's saying, I'm not going to live in this sick culture anymore.
Yep.
That's a serious point. And I think we have our white expectations, which are the Horatio Alger, or mm-hmm. we think that somehow, like, there'll be a happy ending.
Someone will come save the day. And,
yeah. But maybe, like, the unhappy ending is the honest ending.
Sure.
So even, like, it was like To Kill a Mockingbird, right? That's an unhappy ending.
I'm not saying that you can't have an unhappy ending. Goodness, no. I'm just saying it has to be an effective punch of an ending. And I feel like you said it was way too subtle.
Mm-hmm.
So before we get to some of the themes, I did want to mention the acting because I feel like there are incredible performances all around in this film. So Tish and Fonny are played by Kiki Layne and Stefan James. And both of them, as we've sort of already alluded to, just give very tender, mm-hmm. beautiful performances that really form the movie's heart. It's a sensual romance. And when you combine that with Jenkins' visuals, there's something really special at the center of the movie. What do you think about the leads in this?
Yeah, it's just right. It's just, they're like, it's like they're lovers. They're romantic.
Yes.
Like there's like a deep connection and they, it's like they are like soulmates mm-hmm. and like they really play it well.
Yeah.
And you can feel the care they have for one another.
That's right.
It's kind of neat. You don't see that anywhere, you know?
It's so rare.
Yeah.
I'm actually watching Stefan James right now on an Amazon Prime show called Homecoming with Julia Roberts, and he's the main character of that show. And I was struck by how different he is in that show versus this movie, to the point where I thought for a second, is that the same guy? No, it can't be, because he's so different in Beale Street, which is a real credit to his acting. Like if you compare he's in every scene of both, almost in both both the movie and this TV show I'm talking about, Homecoming, and he is so different in the way that he portrays his characters.
He has range. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's one to watch right there. And then a huge shout out to Regina King, who plays Tish's mother. She's very likely to get Best Supporting Actress nomination for this. And for good reason, because she has some powerful moments in this.
She's complex.
Oh yeah,
and like and likable,
uh-huh.
but complex, and then tortured.
Yeah, the weight of a mother's love in the face of things that you don't have control over and you can't fix is just blew me away. Yeah,
there's a scene, I'm sure this is in the novel. I mean, that would be my guess because it's so important, where she has to, she's making this choice whether to wear her wig or not when she goes and has to have this really life-altering meeting.
Yep.
That could change the course of her whole family. She has to decide what look she's going to go. Am I going to go with my who I really am? Am I going to go with this hair that would project something? Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm like unsure of what she's going for. And she decides to, you know, and she goes, she vacillates on that. And she's so strong. She's not the kind of person that would do that. Mm-hmm. So there's like that tension, and it's like this simple act, but you're like, oh, is she going to represent herself in this way or this way?
And it's such a credit to Jenkins too, the way he lingers on that scene. No words, just visually just stays on it. And it's so powerful. Yeah.
And you're feeling like one of the characters could be, is hanging in the balance here.
Of this choice. Yeah.
It's like, well, that's how we, I mean, it's kind of like you ever, if you've ever been on a job interview, mm-hmm. or when you went on a first date, but this is like more than that. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. I've seen tension like that. Yeah. I don't see it very often.
So she's fantastic. But really, there isn't a bad performance in the movie. Everyone is great. I like Tish's dad, played by Coleman Domingo. He was great. And that scene, you know, where the big revelation happens to him was really funny and also touching in a way that you don't see often. And like we mentioned before, Fonny's friend Daniel, that has that really powerful scene at the dinner table, that was haunting stuff. And he really played that well. It's a small part, but that stands out.
Yeah,
when you think about the movie. So, Tim, as we wind down here, what are some themes that really stood out to you as we watch this from a cultural, theological point, wherever you want to go with it?
I think the idea of, I don't know, I think of it as like it's a commentary on America. I don't know how theological. I know that there's a holy roller, like one of the mother-in-law figure, Fonny's mom is kind of like this holy roller figure. Mm-hmm. She's really judgmental.
Yeah.
And kind of makes everyone miserable around her. Everyone. It's
very legalistic, self-righteous version of religion. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like her way of coping with, I looked at that as like her way of coping with the oppression around her is to personalize everything into a moral decision. So you're immoral if this happened. Well, we would have gotten married if we, you know, mm-hmm. so, you know, I think that a lot of white America, especially white evangelicals, actually there was about 20 years ago, there was a survey and it became a book called Divided by Faith.
Oh,
it's an older book, but it's really eye opening. And it was based on, like, I think they surveyed like, I don't know, 5,000 people. And it was talking about attitudes, but the difference between at that point in, I think, 1999, it's 20 years old. But the difference, one of the major differences between black evangelical Christians and white evangelical Christians was that white evangelical Christians saw people's situations as products of all their decisions. So, oh, your kids didn't get a good education. Well, you must have made poor choices.
Yep.
Or, oh, you're pregnant and you're out of wedlock. Oh, you must have made poor choices. And so it's like this. And then African Americans who are evangelicals did not look at it that way. So that was like a major distinction when they were talking about their attitudes and beliefs and behaviors. And I think it's become more polarized that direction these days.
I think so too.
Which is to look at the black experience as a moral failure of black folks.
Yep.
Which I'm like, wow, that is so upside down.
Yep.
I'm like, I was thinking, holy crap.
I was thinking recently that I think that the pull you up by your own bootstraps mentality is an alternate version of the prosperity gospel, mm-hmm. because it's basically saying that if you don't succeed, if you don't achieve the American dream that I've achieved, there's something fundamentally wrong with you.
So I think
virtuous people are successful.
Self-sufficiency. I'm not against capitalism, mm-hmm. but I would tend to say, let's meet real needs.
Yeah.
And I'd say that it's something that, yeah. So I'm not like proposing some alternative system here. But what I would say is, like, that's more of a Protestant work ethic mentality than it is a Christian value. Because, yep. like, it's more Dutch, right?
Yeah,
I mean, like, in the sense of, like, Dutch East India Company, it's more like we've got investors and we're going to make these good decisions. And,
yep.
But I think that's inverted. So the idea that the black experience, which is marked by, in this film, poverty, lack of choices, lack of opportunities, discrimination, no justice, all these different things that's marked by, and people are still making it somehow.
Mm.
Situations that are like untenable.
So, and where people are forced into situations where they have to make choices that they wouldn't have had to make if they were not in those situations. For instance, like the dads have to do stuff that's illegal and they really don't want to.
Yeah.
But they're like, it's our kids' lives. Mm-hmm. So we have to do this. And we've done it before because we've had to.
I like that scene in the bar where they need some money and they're like, well, have you ever had any money? Nope, but we have. Here we are. We've made it this far. That's so powerful.
I know you have a few hustles and I have a few hustles.
Yeah.
And this is our kids we're talking about. So I think that's, and like I see that in scripture too. I see, I'm like, wow, it sounds a little bit like
the shrewd manager.
Well, yeah, but I look at it even like as more in the patriarchs.
Mm.
So it's like, oh, this is like Jacob and Esau, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is very shrewd. But the idea being like sometimes you get put in a situation, and you can see these situations in Schindler's List too, right? Where the situation is making you do things that you wouldn't normally have done ethically because you got to survive.
Mm-hmm.
Or your kids have to survive, or you've got to do all these things. So you're put in these situations that nobody else in this situation that's judging it.
Yeah, right.
But I think the temptation in the American narrative is to blame people for poor choices, where in reality it's like, no, this is an unfair system that's built on slavery and disenfranchisement and all these other factors. And so like, well, that's where the blame is. The blame is a moral failure on the part of the people colonizers,
right?
Well, right,
and it's so easy for
that's the wrong decisions.
Yeah,
the wrong decisions are not. I mean, that's of course, everyone has moral capacity.
Yes,
like there are wrong decisions everywhere, but I'm saying like the big wrong decisions got made a long time ago and are not even being acknowledged now.
And we're not starting at the same starting line. That's the point.
Yeah, starting line, or even that there's rules, like the illusion of rules. That's a wet idea.
Uh-huh.
And so I look at that and I go, like, this is showing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's highlighting it, but it's doing it in not in the, like, way that we see now. Oh, you know, we got to... It's not woke. It's just... It's narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And it's beautiful, and it's relational. It's not, like, on showcase for, oh, look what I know. Or look what my sophisticated political beliefs are that aren't mom and dad's. In reality, you're just reacting to mom and dad. So what I would say is, like, no, this is better. It's this beautiful narrative. And it puts flesh and bone onto these beliefs. Mm-hmm. Or flesh and bone onto this argument. Because I don't think we're persuaded by an argument.
Mm-hmm.
We're persuaded by relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So when we see it. Anyway, I'm all fired up, man. I love it.
Well, you mentioned just you don't know what the theological angle is. I think the theological angle is just that we got to care. Like, that's fundamentally, as white people, we have to do some research and we have to start caring about this problem.
Do you think that'll... I guess I'm more negative.
Okay.
Do you think white people caring is going to do anything about this?
I don't know. But I think that you can't get anywhere if you don't have the knowledge and you don't... I guess from my perspective, I'm just saying I grew up in a very, you know, your typical white suburban bubble where the cops were your friends. And if you ever had a problem, you just call 911 and everything is solved, right? That's what I grew up with. And I didn't have any idea. And it's very easy when you grow up in that. I think a lot of people can relate to that experience. And it's very easy when you do that to grow up and say, well, I did it. Like, what's the problem, right? I was listening to a podcast once where someone was saying like how they were recounting their life story and they, because they were saying, you know, I achieved this success, right? So they were like, yeah, I went to college and then I got out and then, you know, my parents gave me $10,000 and then it's like, wait, what? That's the part that's missing. You know what I'm saying? Like, we have this stuff that's built, baked into our narrative that we don't even think about. It's actually, we received a lot of help too. And we received a lot of things that black people can't relate to. So there's that angle. But just
I just think it's like, I would go with Baldwin. Like, I don't know if our listeners care, but like, my kids are black. Like, we adopted kids and they happen to be black kids. And the more I look at our culture, the more I'm like, this place is so sick.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, let's go to France. Like, that's like where I'm at. Like, I'm at that place. And I've lived all over the country. And I'm like, we are so sick here. It's like, where can I go?
Yeah.
Like, even like when we're traveling and stuff, there's certain, like, if there's places we won't stop. Hmm. There's Confederate flags all over where we go. I get to the point where I'm just like, oh, this is such bull.
Yeah.
Like, why?
Yeah.
Like, what is it? Like, what? It's just, it's like this like corporate mental illness. And I don't mean to like slam mental illness. I mean, I'd say it's like we're deluded, like corporately deluded. I wouldn't call it mental illness. It's an American sickness. Yeah, it's sick.
Yeah.
It's not like mental illness. And, yeah. And I, you know, I'm familiar with mental illness for some other reasons, but I would say it's sickness.
Yep.
And I don't know if it's getting better. And maybe if the guy that wrote this moved to France, maybe that shows us that like this experience is a problem.
Yeah.
And it's bigger than just our attitudes about it. It's like, no, maybe this is so deep that there ain't no fixing it. I mean, I don't know.
You've read The New Jim Crow, right?
Yeah.
So that talks about mass incarceration. That was, I actually just read that about a year ago, and that was a very eye-opening book for me because I did not realize how deep the problem was from a mass incarceration standpoint, which this movie obviously touches on. Also, I would highly recommend Serial. I don't know if you've ever heard that podcast. Season 3, the reporters just camped out in a Cleveland courtroom for a year and basically just watched cases come in and watched and followed up with what happened to those people. And when you piece those things together of what the system is like, you see that under the guise of color blindness, right? Because that's what we're under. It's like, hey, the same laws apply to everyone. So obviously if you're in jail, it's your fault because the same, but then you realize actually certain cultures are systematically being targeted. This began with the war on drugs back in the 80s. It's like, no, we made a choice. Even though drugs are both a black and white person problem equally, we made a choice to focus on these neighborhoods.
Yeah, like Alexander talks about like, well, you want to go find some drugs, go to the frat house.
Yeah. Exactly.
You know, like they're there.
Statistically, exact same drug usage, but we've made a conscious decision to focus on these neighborhoods in our targeting. And so,
you get less pushback.
That's right. That's right. You don't have, you attack a suburban, you know, mayor's house and all of a sudden you've got the governor on the phone, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
So, but just the idea of the system where, first of all, the first level of just black people going to jail without, you're accused of something, you're not even found guilty, you're just, but then to await your court date, you're just languishing in jail and you often don't have the bail money to get out. And that right there can ruin your life. Think about that. You haven't actually been found guilty of anything. And in a lot of cases, you're totally innocent, but you're in jail for a year. You've lost your house. You've lost your job, potentially your marriage.
Right. So you may not be able to post bail. So remember, there was the economic factor of justice in this movie that came up. Mm-hmm. So the idea of like, well, we need to get money so we can go like meet with a witness or whatever.
In Puerto Rico. Yeah.
And the idea of that, I mean, that was heightened. That's probably not always the case. But the idea, or how about just bail? Mm-hmm. How are we going to make bail money?
Right.
Well, a lot of people would have like, oh, well, I can just, you know, call a few people and I got enough connections and social capital, I can make bail. Or I might have it in my retirement account.
Yeah, or credit card account, right? But a lot of people don't have that. Yeah.
But like a lot of folks, like especially, you know, folks that have been marginalized for generations may not have like any kind of extra money. Mm-hmm. And so, because they're getting by, you know? And so this film is like, well, if you don't have that, you're not going to get justice. I mean, that's really what they're...
that's right.
And so I think your point is well taken.
And then even when you get to the next level, what you see in Serial Season 3 is that the lawyers like to put as many charges against you as possible in the hopes that you'll settle. That you'll plead down. Right. So you actually have a lot of people that are pleading guilty to things they didn't do because the choice is, well, you can go to trial and face 150 years or you can plead out and do time served.
So then you plea bargain to a felony and now you're not employable.
Right. You plea bargain to a felony. Different
kind of, you become like a second class citizen.
You become, right. You can't get government assistance. You can't get housing. You can't get jobs. But you already were. Yes. And you can't go back and say, well, I didn't actually do that crime because you pleaded guilty. You're a convicted felon from that point forward, you know? So anyway, it's just getting to the point where the whole system is legitimately rigged. And
it's not getting there. We've been there for hundreds of years.
Right. And that's the reality.
Yeah, I know what you mean, though.
And that's the reality. And I just think as Christians, we have to learn about that. We have to care about that. Will that make a difference? I don't know. I'm probably as cynical as you are on that subject, but...
The sickest part is when the Christians align... This is like, we're like, you're hitting in a vein of pissed here for me. We're like, it's the mother load here.
Yep.
The part that drives me the most insane is when white Christians align themselves with white nationalism and racism and a false patriotism that is only available to white Christians. That to me is like, it's disgusting. It's a misappropriation of scripture. It's a misappropriation of gospel. It's only good news if for the, you know, in healing for the well healed.
Mm.
And I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me angry. And it's just disgusting to me. And I say that because I hear it and there's different conversations. You get different conversations depending on who you talk to.
Yep.
That makes me incredibly angry. Now my anger, where does it go? Who knows? But what I would say is like, I don't see any kind of solution. I think we have this progressive notion that here's a problem, let's solve it.
Yep.
I mean, if you think about, like, if you're Black American, you've been how many generations of this have been and you've been through civil rights and you thought there was a solution. You've been through all this stuff. There was right. a solution. Oh, the emancipation. Okay, the slaves are free. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. The Klan's coming back up. It's the 1920s and now I can't. Jim Crow.
Just like we were talking
now
about
you're
the beginning.
Like, oh, you know, Rosa yeah. Parks. Okay, cool. Yeah. Integration. Oh, wait a sec. No, this is like just like on the surface. There's still like de facto.
Like we were saying in the beginning, yeah. it's like Beale Street took place in the 70s. And that was such like, oh, wait, we're dealing with the exact same problem.
It's 50 years later, folks. And it's like our dialogue isn't changed. So the film is the same as, I mean, we're still talking the same dialogue. Oh, what's the solution? We could do this. We could do that. We'll bus people here. We'll do that.
Yep.
So we're trying to socially, I think the social engineering is like really interesting.
Yeah.
Or even policy. Michelle Alexander and her new, she has a, she's added a chapter to that book.
Mm.
And it talks about like, no, even like policy. Because a lot of people who are more progressive said, oh, we can change the policy. We can change the law. Then we can change the country.
Mm-hmm.
To a point.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't change hearts and minds and attitudes, you can't. And how do you do that? So, and is that even like in community organizing, you talk about winnable?
Yeah.
And if I was going to evaluate this whole situation, I'm like, this ain't winnable. Let's just get out of here. And there's, and there's a lot of Black folks that have written about that throughout the years. Like, well, you just need to get out of here.
Well, and you've got skin yeah. in the game, man. I mean, you're raising yeah. Black boys and girls. And if I was in your shoes, I'd want to get out too.
But how ingrained are we in the system too? So like the other part of the system, and we tell people this, our children are the result of the state taking Black children from a Black family.
Hmm.
Like that happened. It was a tragedy, right?
Yeah.
So the very joy in our life is coming from a tragedy for someone else.
Yeah.
Now, does their Blackness made, is that why they were taken away? I don't know. This is all like pretty personal. But what I would say is like, even our experience has parts of the system in it that are questionable, where you go, was there justice in certain parts of these in their lives? Is there, why were they in these situations?
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. and in the first place. So anyway, so I guess what I'm trying to explain is there's a very deep wound here that I don't know if young progressive people are going to just be able to like fix it. Cause that
with the right policy or the right president or whatever you
right,
want to
say. Or right. even like right social media or right beliefs or yep. right attitudes. And I'd be like, I don't know. We need like I don't know. I think of like an Exodus event, right?
Hmm.
Where everything gets turned upside down in a miraculous kind of way. And we see that in the Gospels.
Yeah.
You see this upside down kingdom where everything gets switched around.
And
then Jesus is like, you better realign now because it's all going to be flipped. And then I look at the statistics like, okay, yeah, white folks are basically losing power each year. And we're like, we're in the last gasps of white folks being in power.
For sure.
So I'm like, well, you better get it right now because there's going to be a shift. If you hate Black folks and you hate immigrants and you hate all these other folks, you know, as white folks, there's going to be a shift. And you better be, and I'm going to give you a little hint of which side Jesus is on. I was like into the movie, but then you tapped into a vein of like despair in me.
But that is the movie. I mean, honestly.
It is. Yeah. It is. It is that last scene. So watch the movie. Watch the last scene.
That's right.
The last scene is America.
All right, Tim, what are your final thoughts on Beale Street?
Not the best film of the year. A really good film. It's not hit you over the head powerful like, say, like some other films, like Spike Lee films. Not Black Klansman, but...
Or Moonlight.
Or Moonlight's still soft, but it's like also... It does have more power than this film.
Yeah.
But I would say this is a good... This is an A. This film is an A.
Straight A.
Well, yeah, but like it's not the best film I've seen all year. But okay. I would give it an A.
So you give it a perfect grade.
I mean, like an A plus would be perfect for me, right? Or an A perfect for me?
No, A minus.
A minus then. Okay. Let's get consistent.
I don't mean it's your grade. You can give it whatever you want.
You just tell me what to think, John, and I'll just do what you say.
In my mind, an A is literally there's nothing wrong with the movie. Do you believe that?
No, I think there are things that you could do in this movie. But I also look at it as like, hey, you know what? It's an adapted book. Okay, mm-hmm. There's so much you can do with it. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, The Godfather is an adapted book too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, but there's so much you can do with it. But I would say it's like not the best film of the year. I would still say Roma is, I think the cinematography is weak to a certain, I mean, I think they have great shots and the lighting is really good. But I would say compared to some of the other filmmakers, like for instance, just look at Roma, and then you can see that the cinematography of Roma is a lot better. They do a lot of moving camera, like dynamic camera shots with this, where like you have like a lot of people circling, but that's almost cliche now. You
get love that.
Yeah, it's great, but you get that in TV now even.
Yeah.
Where I would say it doesn't have quite the artistic edge that you're going to get from the film I think is going to win, Roma.
I completely agree that Roma is a better film, by the way. Totally. So I would definitely recommend the movie. There are scenes in this film that are among the most powerful moments you'll find of any movie in 2018. I think that's unquestionable. That table scene, for instance, with Fonny and his friend, I think is one of the most powerful things I've seen all year. Mm-hmm. But as a whole, I'm going with a B+. It was really on the verge. I was whether it was going to be an A- or a B+, but I ultimately landed on a B+. For the criticisms I said, just the way the movie, I think it's a little choppy, the way the movie is constructed, the voiceover, and then the ending. But it's still a must-see movie. I do think it's... Go ahead, what?
Is it better than First Man?
I do not think it's better than First Man.
I don't either.
I don't.
And I really love the narrative. I love the characters. I thought it was a beautiful film. Mm-hmm. But I think First Man is just the cinematography, the direction, the film
it's tighter.
It's just tighter. It's a better film.
Yep.
And it's more of an achievement to me.
But Moonlight was better than La La Land, in my opinion.
I agree also.
Yeah. It is in my top 10 of the year. I think it's at like number 6 or something. So it did make my top 10, and I strongly recommend watching it in theaters while you can. It's everywhere right now. So see it. All right, Tim, that is our first podcast of the new year, but we are actually, heads up, not going to have a podcast next month because it is Oscar month. I know. We usually do take off in February. It's Oscar month. I do a lot of write-ups for the website, but don't worry, you can still get your Cinema Faith fix if you join us on Oscar night on February 24th. That is Sunday, February 24th, because Tim, myself, and Dan Baker will be live tweeting during the entire Oscar ceremony.
Dan's will be sophisticated.
But you'll be funny.
You full always... fraught with illusion.
Yes. Well, no, Dan has a very witty, sideways look at things, which I love. And
John,
I can never replicate.
You think Dan is twisted and evil.
No. That's not what I'm saying.
Incapable of love.
He just has a very clever way of looking at something, right?
I know what
you
mean.
And you're just like, you just make me laugh by you guys have a very like direct comedy. And then, as I always say, I'm the sincere guy who's just always like, I'm so glad that won. And
we balance sincerity. Each other. We need sincerity because you can't just be cynical your whole life. Right.
Well, I'm just not as clever as you and Dan, but that's okay.
No.
I'll be the sincere one, and we need all of it.
No, Dan's the cleverest.
He is. No, he is. Yeah. He's our social media guru.
Let's give him the like credit where, you know. Yeah, that's what
Dan's
he does.
Dan's awesome.
Dan
just pulls a gif off the internet and slaps it on a tweet, and it's just like, well, how did you do that?
I just want to click on anything that has Dan Baker related.
I'm in awe of him.
Yes. Yeah.
Let's
give him some more praise.
I'm sure he's listening and loving every minute of this.
Yeah.
Hi, Dan. We love you.
Yeah.
So, Oscar night, come join us live tweeting throughout the whole ceremony, and that will be your Cinema Faith fix for February because we will not have a podcast. And then in March, we will regroup and we will review our first official 2019 movie, whatever that is.
What do you think it's going to be, John?
I don't know.
I don't know.
March
either.
Is like the dog days of cinema. I remember like we did that one Coen Brothers movie that one year in March, with George Clooney.
With the multiple Heston-esque.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Yeah.
That's a March movie, right?
Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar is your typical March movie. So we will find something in that vein and something that we probably won't be talking about at the end of the year, but it'll be a kickoff nonetheless to a new year in film. And
it could be like April for me where I catch up on all the stuff you've already seen months ago.
It'll all come out to streaming and then you can watch
all these like artistic films will be on Amazon Prime.
Absolutely.
Can I ask you this question?
Yeah, go ahead.
I know we've gone very long today.
It's all right.
If you had to have Amazon Prime or Netflix, which would you choose?
Amazon Prime, of course.
Really?
I'm an Amazon Prime junkie. It's so sad because
HBO, huh?
Well, HBO, yeah. And you know why? Because you can get the HBO add-on with Hulu, but do you know what Hulu does? In their infinite wisdom, they decided to add the little HBO symbol at the bottom right corner throughout the entire episode,
which is
so annoying, and it distracts from the art. Amazon does not do that. Amazon just gets all the little things right that all these other streaming platforms cannot compete with. And it's sad because I feel bad because Amazon's taking out local businesses. They're basically taking over the world. I know.
There's an Alexa in the corner. Is that Google? No, that's Amazon.
But Jeff Bezos.
There's a listening device in the corner, John. I'm totally serious. We should ever like kind of send us out, maybe.
It's so true. Jeff Bezos has followed through on his promise of wanting to make Amazon Prime so good that you'd be stupid not to have it. And I think he's done it, unfortunately. And once he and Disney join together, I think we'll just sign over our paycheck to them, and that will be that.
That's where they'll come from.
Yeah,
we'll all be on like on the payroll.
That's right.
It'll be a one world government.
Anyway, so on that note,
and it'll be a corporation.
Systematic injustice and one world government. That's about your podcast for the day. Great. Glad you listened. Thank you for joining in. As always, we will be back in March 2019. Don't forget our live tweeting on Oscar night. And until then, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.